You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Juliana Garcia. Juliana, it's good to have you here this morning.
Thanks for inviting me on. I'm super excited.
Good. So we begin with a question to just give some context and to start our conversation. Who are you? What are the labels or the qualities or the stories that we need to start with?
So I'm originally from Fort Worth, Texas. It's next to Dallas. I came up here to go to school. I went to Cornell, graduated in 2014. I studied industrial and labor relations, but about halfway through, I kind of realized that wasn't really my thing. It was kind of too late in the game to change up what I was doing. So I just started taking a lot of classes on psychology and neuroscience because I was really interested in the intersection of neuroscience and law and how that played out. So I ended up doing that, and then I stayed in Ithaca because I was working in a neuroscience lab, so I just wanted to continue down that path. And then I was like, just kidding, I'm going to switch to social work. So I've kind of been all over the place with my decisions for my life, but right now I'm at Family and Children's as the runaway homeless youth worker. So I really like that, and I think I'm going to stay in that for a while.
And this is the beginning of a career. I mean, yes. this is the way life starts on some
Definitely.
Level. Yeah. Yeah. So you will have more stories. We will unpack some of that intro as we go forward. But you brought some music with you, and we're going to start with Jackie and Wilson by Hozier. Do you want to say something about that selection, why you picked that song?
I bought the Hozier album because I was really in love with that song, Take Me to Church, which was super popular everywhere. And I really fell in love with this song, Jackie and Wilson, just the beat. And everything about it. The whole album is fantastic, but this song especially, I just love to jam to it at home. So hopefully everyone enjoys it.
So here we go.
So tired trying to see from behind. Find a place we could escape sometime. Me and my eyes just growing black irises in the sunshine. With every version of me dead and buried in the yard outside. Sit back and watch the world go by. Happy to lie back. Watch it burn. Up from a cigarette, she's already left. yard for what's left of me in our little vignette. One ever poor soul is coming in. She's gonna save me, call me baby. Under her head to my head. She'll know me crazy, soothe me daily. And yet she wouldn't care. It's the Alexis B. Detective. Ride around picking up food. We'll name our children Jackie and Wilson. Raise them all rhythm and blues.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and that was Hozier and Jackie and Wilson, the tune. And our guest on this hour is Juliana Garcia. So Juliana, tell me, what experience has helped to kind of get you launched in life? What has helped to define your life and the trajectory? You've already made several decision changes, but
yes.
what gave you the right or the sense that you could do that?
Yes.
Yeah.
So I feel like it's hard to pinpoint specific instances, but definitely the choice
Definitely.
So the choice to get out of Texas was one of the main ones. I totally love Texas. I'm going there on Monday to visit, but just to get out and see the world.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, let's see, the furthest place away from here. And it looked like it was Ithaca. So I hopped on a plane and came to Ithaca. So I think that, and then just my whole experience at Cornell is very different than what I was used to.
Mm-hmm.
I went to a Catholic school. It was really intense. And then I came to Cornell. And
but for you, what was intense about the Catholic school experience?
It was very much, you know.
And where in Texas were you?
I was in Fort Worth.
Okay.
And so it was very much about, you know, kind of believing what they believe and not really giving you a choice to think
mm-hmm.
what you want to think. And I realize not all Catholic schools are like that. And I got a great education from there, so I can't really knock it. But I just remember this one instance, and it was totally odd to me, where it was very like teaching about abstinence. Like that was what they
mm-hmm.
did.
Mm-hmm.
That was like the sex ed, you know? And they were teaching this class about abstinence as the girl sitting next to me was like 6 months pregnant. So it's like, clearly this isn't working, you know,
right.
like maybe you
right.
should do something else.
Right.
So anyways, short of that, I came to Cornell, and I remember I took a speech and debate class, and it was kind of, more of a fun class than what you would normally take. And at the end of the semester, I remember the professor saying that if I haven't taught you anything, hopefully I taught you how to think for yourself. And that really resonated with me, because it's like, wow, that's what my whole experience here is doing, is teaching me to think for myself,
mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
and not like cramming something down my throat and saying, okay, mm-hmm. this is what you're going to think. It's like, mm-hmm. how do you take this knowledge and kind of parse it out and say, okay, I think that is right, or maybe I should do a little bit more looking. So I would say that one class and just that, you know, one experience kind of brought my whole Cornell experience together. So,
and when in your Cornell experience did you take that class?
It was my senior year.
Okay,
so it was so, like, wow,
yeah,
this
yeah,
is crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So it worked out really nicely. I don't know if I would have heard the message my freshman year. I probably would have just been like, cool.
Right. So what kind of family situation or what kind of, you know, background put you into Catholic school? And when you describe the intensity, what I have is this vision of kind of you being in something of an enclosed jar and the pressure kind of building up inside as you become more aware that
yeah,
you may want
definitely.
Different choices. But anyway, but tell us about your family. And
yeah, definitely. So my family is Mexican-American, which usually Mexicans are very Catholic. So everyone in my family is pretty Catholic. So it was just the natural decision to send me to Catholic school. Also, public education in Texas is pretty bad. So if you want a good education, mm-hmm. you kind of have to go to private school. And most of the private schools have some sort of religious affiliation. So it was kind of just like, which one would we fit into? So I grew up from like first grade to 12th grade rocking a uniform. So yeah, my family is super awesome. I can't wait to visit them tomorrow. This is a big deal because I only see him once a year, so it's like all the hype is coming up.
Right.
But yeah, they're still all living in Fort Worth. I get to call them from time to time, so it's nice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what was I mean, I know a little bit about Fort Worth, but not
mm-hmm.
much. one of the leading seminaries in my historical tradition, Bright Seminary at Texas Christian University, is
mm-hmm. TCU.
is located there. But what about life in Texas for you was different than life here? And why are you staying here as opposed to going back there?
Well, Ithaca is just kind of a little bit crazy itself. Mm-hmm. You That's know, right. just a lot of different people, different things. I would remember going back for breaks, going back to Texas, and it's very much the same there. Like, everyone's very similar. Mm-hmm. And it might just be the people who I, you know, hung out with and went to high school with, things like that. I could maybe
the people you know are the
same.
There.
Basically. Yeah. And it seemed like things weren't really changing for them, and it wasn't much like thinking outside the box, things like that. And I was like, wow, I really love being in Ithaca and love being challenged by all the different kinds of people. So I was like, I think I'm going to stay here. And I totally want to move to Austin at some point. I don't know if you've ever been there, but that's probably the most progressive place in Texas.
Right. There's a big flow of people between Ithaca and Austin. Yes.
Definitely. Yes. I spent a summer there, and that was just the best thing ever. So hopefully I can make it back down there. But so far, it looks like I'm going to stay in Ithaca for a little bit. I'm liking it a lot.
Yeah. So how did you discover the ILR school? I mean, that seems like it's the smallest school at Cornell, and in many ways the least known, and you're coming, from a long ways away.
Yeah. It was honestly the most ridiculous thing ever. So I was like, okay, I'm going to be a lawyer. You know, when you're in high school, you decide what you're going to do, and obviously that changes. And on the computer, when you're going through and choosing what major you want to be, it's like, hey, you should apply to this school if you want to be this. So it's like, okay, you want to do pre-law? And then it sent me to the ILR school. So I didn't really know a lot about the ILR school. I was just like, oh, that's where you go if you want to be a lawyer.
Right. Yeah. And did you have much in the way of vocational guidance at your school? I imagine that when you're applying so far away, were you getting much help?
No, they thought it was a joke that I was applying to Cornell because people pretty much stay in the area. You go to TCU, you go to UT, you go to one of the community colleges, and they were like, no, like, are you kidding me?
Right.
I remember that was actually another defining moment because my guidance counselor kind of laughed it off, and was like, yeah, that's no. and I was like, no, I'm going to apply. You can help me or I can do this on my own, So I ended up applying and getting in, and that was pretty awesome. So, but yeah.
Yeah. And actually, there's a funny tie here. I believe that the wife of this generation's Ezra Cornell actually is a graduate of TCU.
Really?
And she grew up Disciples in Missouri, in my religious tradition, about 30 miles from where I grew up in Missouri. So there are some funny cross ties here. This is with lots of people flowing in and out.
Definitely.
So as you were doing your coursework, what about ILR kind of ceased to fit for you, and how did you navigate that? Because I tend to interview older people, but you've been through a number of changes, and changes that come with big either commitment tags or price tags, and so how did you figure that out?
So I was super into the pre-law thing, and I really wanted to do criminal law. So industrial labor relations, not really like that at all. And I really enjoyed my classes on labor unions, labor law, things like that. But it just wasn't really exciting me. You know how some things, that's not really your thing. Yeah. So I wasn't really feeling that.
It was the occasion of your getting out of Texas to college.
Yeah, definitely. So I ended up kind of traveling down that criminal law path. And I interned at the Texas Criminal Court of Appeals. So in Texas, there are two Supreme Courts. One's for like the criminal appeals and the other side. So I did the Criminal Court of Appeals, and basically, if you get the death penalty sentenced to you, it goes straight up to the Criminal Court of Appeals.
Right.
So while I was interning there, I got to hear about a lot of these cases, because as you know, in Texas, we're like executing people left and right. So I got to hear about a lot of these cases, and as I was listening to it and reading through all of these, I was kind of realizing that a lot of these people had just a lot of bad things happened to them in their past, so it wasn't like they grew up in this like splendid neighborhood and went to this awesome school and then just ended up murdering like five people. You know, it's like they came from a really poor neighborhood. Their parents did drugs, things like that, so it's like all of these past things that kind of happened to them that put them in this bad situation and had, they made these bad choices. So I was kind of thinking about that. And then I was listening to NPR on my way home from a drive one day. And David Engelman, this neuroscientist, came on and he started talking about the intersection of neuroscience and law. So he came from more of a background that like your brain, you kind of make decisions beforehand. We all know about that, how it's like the decision is kind of processing for a few days, and then finally you end up doing it.
Right. You discover you've been thinking about it and processing it all along. Yeah.
So thinking about that, and then also thinking about, you know, where people come, their actual background, I was like, wow, why are we putting all these people to death? You know, so I started questioning the system that we had. And that's what kind of led me down the psychology, neuroscience path. And I feel like I can also kind of relate that back to what I'm doing now, social sure. work yeah. type stuff, because it all plays into like the making of a person. So I explored the neuroscience background, realized it was pretty intense in the sense that, you know, lots of computer programming and things that I wasn't super into.
Right.
So I kind of switched over to the social work type thing. So that's the bridge version, basically, mm-hmm. of how that.
Well, but unpack that a little bit. Why did you leave the more kind of science, data-driven mm-hmm. Side of the problem mm-hmm. to the more interactive, interpretive, much less easy to kind of nail down,
yes.
You know, and people who were like cats, hurting, I mean, why did, you know, and you know, why did you make that transition?
So I pretty much came back from that internship. I think it was my junior year. I came back and I was like, I'm going to be in a neuroscience lab, you know, and I jumped into it without really knowing what I was getting into. So it was like a really steep learning curve first off. Mm-hmm. And everyone I was working with had, you know, this
2 years
their major.
Or more behind.
Yeah. And they had all these science courses and all these statistic courses. And I was just like, I have no idea what I'm doing right now.
Right.
So the learning curve was pretty steep. I started to get the hang of it in like a crash course year, you know?
Right.
But I realized it wasn't really my thing. I didn't want to be stuck behind a desk mm-hmm. all day, like, you know, doing research. As much as I love research, I would prefer, like, translational research where you can, like, kind of take it into the community and say, here, this is what we're going to do, instead of just publishing papers and stuff like that, which I, you know, they are helpful, but I prefer working one-on-one with a person,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So I kind of realized, like, that's not really my thing because I'm not really interacting with people and trying to figure out, like, the root of the problem
right.
in the sense of, like, talking one-on-one. So that's what led me down the path of, like, you know, the social work type thing and what I'm doing now.
Right. Now, are you a first-generation college student? Or, mm-hmm. or okay. So I mean, I too, am a first-generation college student. And when I came to Cornell in 1976, I started out in a – I got to be a college scholar very quickly. Mm-hmm. And I did, was doing anthropology – I was doing anthropology, Latin American studies, and creative writing because mm-hmm. I thought I would write, you know. I would write the American version of 100 Years of Solitude, you
yeah.
know, or whatever. I discovered – halfway through that I really wanted to do something that was much more concrete and less nebulous.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to do biology. So I ended up with anthropology, biology, and ethics.
Mm-hmm.
But in that time, we had to do this really intense kind of catch-up with all the science. So I know a bit about what you're talking
yes.
about. But the reason I kind of tell this story is when you're a first-generation college student, you don't know what your career options are.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
And so you kind of lock into something that feels good, sounds good, and then you either have to find a way gracefully out of it or a way to make it work. And you've done...
Yep.
Is that... Where do you get that skill from? Or do you, or have you thought about that? Because that's, you know, the skill to think, you know, I can make a change.
Yeah, I mean... I feel like probably from my mom, definitely, because uh-huh. she like switched career paths like really hardcore and was just like, cool, this is what I'm doing. You know,
right.
she went from working for the sheriff's office to being our county clerk uh-huh. for our county. So uh-huh. it was just like a huge switch.
Right.
So I think just watching her and seeing that she could go through life without any fear of like, oh, what will people think if I change my career right now? You know, and she was always very supportive of me because I was like, I don't know if I want to, you know, do this neuroscience thing. She was like, that's fine. You don't have to, you know, like do what you want. If it's not making you happy, then try something else. You know,
right.
She was like, you're still young. She was like, just keep trying until you find something you like. And then when you don't like that anymore, go on to the next thing, you know. So I feel like a lot of support from her and from the rest of my family and letting me choose what I wanted to do and not really coming down on me.
Right, right, right.
When I decided to switch paths. So.
Yeah,
that was
yeah.
pretty helpful.
No, and hearing that story, hopefully, will help other people have that kind of grace toward their own
mm-hmm.
young adult.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the thing is, as long as you don't burn the bridges, that you're leaving, then mm-hmm. you're totally fine. Mm-hmm. Like, I still talk to the professor that I worked for. You know, I told him this wasn't really my thing. It's not like mm-hmm. I was like, I hate this, I'm leaving. You know, it's like, I don't, you know, I don't really think this is my thing, and I want to give you the best work that you can get.
Right.
So I feel like as long as people know, just, you know, keep the relationship intact and kind of explain where you're coming from. Usually people, especially employers, are very understanding because they want you to be the best employee you can be. And if you feel like you can't be that person, you know, it's not mutually beneficial.
Right. And you stay with something long enough to really get to know each other and, mm-hmm. and to make that a logical move.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, not after a month. Peace
yeah,
out.
But. Yeah. So let's segue to some music again. What should we play next?
Okay. I think we could play Come and Get Your Love by Redbone.
Okie doke. And this version will have a lead-in that has some Native American dancing on it, because this was played on public television in 1974, back when I was in high school. In fact, I may even remember the original playing of this. We'll see. Thank you. that was Redbone and Come and Get Your Love, the Midnight Special in 1974. Anyway, our guest on this is the Made of Clay Report, and you're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. And our guest on this hour is Juliana Garcia. So Juliana, you've talked about following your passions and having kind of the encouragement of your mother to do that, and this is your life. What has you what rivets you about your work at Family and Children's?
So I kind of dove into it without really knowing what to do. And fortunately, I was given a lot of training, because otherwise I would just not know at all how to help these kids that I work with. But it's interesting to see how many of our youth kind of fly under the radar too. So it's couch surfing. Homelessness, like youth homelessness, right, is mostly couch surfing. Right. And a lot of people don't really see that. You just see this person who comes to school every day, misses school sometimes, but they are going somewhere every night. It's not like you see a bunch of kids on the street, you know?
Right. And they have more or less direction. My daughter had a friend who couch surfed so she could emancipate herself and be free of parents who had addiction issues, you know? And yeah, it's lots of reasons. Yeah.
So I mean, there are a lot of reasons, and a lot of people don't see it. So it's pretty interesting working with these kids and just to see how strong they are and how resourceful they are. Like I was working with a youth who had been couch surfing for a few months. And like every day at sixth period during school, he would start texting people, you know, to figure out who he could stay with. And it's like, well, no wonder like schoolwork suffers with some of these youth because they're worrying about more basic needs. Like, where am I going to sleep? What kind of food am I going to get tonight? All those kind of things. So we come from like a strengths-based approach. So it's like, oh, you're a really resourceful kid. How can we use that to make your life better? You know,
So what do you do? I mean, when you say that, what do they say back? And what's the dance that?
Yeah. So, our program, Open Doors program, the one I work for, is, family reunification. Whereas the Learning Web, I don't know if you're familiar with the Learning Web.
Yes, a little bit,
yeah. So they're more independent living. So that's kind of how we parse out the two. It's like, if you want to go home with your family, and some kids are just absolutely, they're like, I'm not going home tonight. I'm not going home ever.
Right.
But after working with them for a week, they go back home.
Right.
You know, so it's not really telling people, and I'm sure you know this, it's not really telling them what to do. It's like, how do you come to this decision on your own? You know?
Right. How do you ask the questions? How do you listen? How do you be present with them long enough, clear enough?
Yes, it was a huge switch to work with teenagers because they just don't really see the big picture a lot of the times. It's more like, what will make me happy right now? What's working right now? So it's a lot of like questioning their decisions. So it's like, well, if you did this, what do you think the outcome would be?
Right.
You know, and it's like, that probably wouldn't be the best outcome. So it's having a lot of patience, you know, to tell them like, that's not a good decision. And here are the reasons why. What are your thoughts about that? You know? But yeah, so what I do is help with basic needs. So I'll take kids to, the food banks and stuff around town, food pantries, to get food, show them how to do that. Because a lot of people just aren't familiar with it. Doing that, finding like right now, winter clothes is a big thing. So just finding who has winter clothes available and where they can get it from, bus passes, all that kind of stuff, a lot of basic needs. And then also a lot of like safety planning, you know, so if you're going to stay, you know, somewhere else other than your home tonight, who are good friends? And like, you know, do you think they're safe to be with? Because some people aren't necessarily safe to stay with. It's like, yeah, you can sleep on their couch, but it's like kind of a sketchy thing. So
Right. And what are the biggest safety issues for these teens?
The biggest safety issues for the girls, it would be sexual exploitation. We were kind of talking about this during the break, but that would be it. I found with a lot of youth, they think they're the ones who's taking advantage of the person. So it's like, well, he's giving me a phone and he's giving me a ride and he's giving me food. So it's like, I'm actually the one taking advantage of him. And it's like, no, if you have to do like,
so they feel indebted if they feel like, or they feel like they have
not really indebted, more like empowered. And it's like, cool, I can use like my body to get what I want. That kind of thing.
Right.
And it's like, you know,
it's a deal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, you're not really the one in power right now, but it's hard to see that. Cause it's like, well, I'm getting what I want, you know? So usually talking through those things, I found that's one of the big ones is sexual exploitation of youth. And then just safety, overall safety, in terms of like drug use, things like that. If you're in a house where there's a lot of drug use, you're staying with a friend, something happens, you could get in trouble. Just all those things, physical safety, you know, if you're walking into a situation, you don't know who's there kind of thing. So.
Right. Right, right. You're sleeping in the middle of a lot of other chaos, or trying
to. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So the trajectory, you see the youth before they either go into the program at where they're staying independent or they're going back to their family. You see them in this transition time.
It's usually crisis, yeah. Right. So a kid will say, I'm not going home tonight, I'm going to run away or something. Mm-hmm. So a school will call me and say, hey, we have a kid, like, can you come talk to them? So it's usually in times of crisis I show up, and then once the crisis is over and they are back at home and stable, I kind of close with them.
Mm-hmm.
So I usually only see the, like, really intense period.
Right.
And hopefully things continue on to be good after that. But yeah, usually with my youth, it's up to 21. The Learning Web, it's up to 24.
Mm-hmm.
So if a youth I'm working with is 21 and they decide, like, no, I really just want to do my own thing, then I refer them over to the Learning Web,
because
that's more appropriate, the services
right,
there.
Right. What kinds of things have you had to learn? You said that you jumped into this job kind of totally taken by it, but totally, in some sense, not quite prepared.
Yeah.
What has been most shocking for you to learn, and what are some of the skills that you've had to pick up very quickly?
Yes. I would say trauma-informed care is something I had to learn about, because I didn't really know about it before.
What is trauma-informed care?
So understanding that people come from a trauma background, acknowledging that trauma, and saying, how can we move on from there, instead of just ignoring it and saying, okay, you had trauma, but, you know, that doesn't mean you shouldn't act this way. So acknowledging, like, okay, these bad behaviors, bad actions are kind of coming from this place of trauma. So how do we acknowledge that and move forward? So it's also going into the strengths-based approach. So it's like, even though you did have these traumas, you do have these strengths. You're really resilient. You know, you're really resourceful, things like that. So just kind of learning that, and being able to work with people who might be, work with youth who might be hard to work with, as in they don't really want your help, things like that. And it's like, well, why don't you appreciate me? You know, I'm just trying to help you. But it's like, when you're coming from this trauma background, you don't trust people sometimes. You know, if you've had that where people constantly let you down, then of course you're not going to trust me when I show up and say, I'm here to help, you know?
Well, yeah. And it's also, you know, on whose terms are you here to help? You know, who are you really helping? And then kids are savvy that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
How do you acknowledge the trauma? I mean, how do you let them know that I in some sense understand or accept, or that's a big piece of what drives you? How do you
convey
that?
I mean, sometimes
that?
You have to just say that, because a lot of times you're not going to have those same experiences, you know? So it's just acknowledging that, wow, that was a really hard thing that you went through, and I'm glad to see that you came out on the other side, and I know that impacts your life. But we need to keep going forward, you know, acknowledging it and saying, wow, that was really hard. Like, I can't imagine what that's like, because, you know, sometimes I don't share the same experiences as my youth.
Right.
So you can't say, oh yeah, that was whatever, you know?
What got you started isn't necessarily what will keep you going, but we've got to start with the energy that propelled you to where you are now. Is there anything else about the work that you'd like to say in terms of?
Yeah, we actually, so we offer respite care. So host homes are kind of on our agenda right now, and that's something I just wanted to talk about.
Sure.
So it's different in the sense that it's not foster care. It's, say, I had a blow up with my mom, you know, and I was like, I'm not going home tonight, and you just need a day to cool down. Well, you know, we offer host homes where you can stay for the night, and then the next day we'll do a family meeting. So right now we only have one host home, and we're kind of looking for more. So if anyone wants to be a host home, Family and Children's needs some. But it's a really nice option to have for youth, instead of saying, like, I don't know where I'm going to stay, or, you know.
How would people get a hold of you or the program to let them know that they would be willing to be a host home, or at least willing to explore what that would entail?
You can just call Family and Children's main line and, you know, just ask, because then they'll direct you over to Youth and Services.
Okay.
I can't remember the number off the top
of
my head.
No, okay, but that's enough.
Yeah, you just call Family and Children's and ask, and they can give you all the information.
Right. And, you know, we have, you know, this is a powerful need. How many youth at any given time? I mean, how many youth a week do new youth come into this experience of homelessness or couch surfing? And how many at any time do you estimate are living kind of on their own?
I would say we were kind of at a steady flow of 2 to 3 crises per week, as in people calling and saying that they needed help, and you would spend a few hours with them during that day trying to figure out, like driving around with them, saying, okay, where are you going to stay tonight? Let's just, you know, drive around town until we make a good plan. So that's a pretty high number, 2 to 3 per week.
Right.
Right now, my caseload is about 8. So 8 people that I'm working with.
Mm-hmm.
Usually you see spikes during certain times.
Sure.
So when school started, it kind of went crazy.
And it may spike with the holidays.
Exactly. Yeah. So with the holidays, we're expecting to see something. It's just kind of ebbs and flows. We just started this program in January, so we're coming up on the first year.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a whole new thing for everyone. We're just trying to see what's going on. So we haven't even had the year behind us yet.
Right.
So it's subject to change. But I would say typically 2 to 3 crises per week of new people come up.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a pretty high number, you know.
Yeah, no, for a community that has, let's just say, we've got about 400 per grade level in the Ithaca City School District, and we've got three or four other school districts in the area that have maybe 80 to 60 to 100 per grade level. We got, you know, there are not that many kids, you know.
Yes.
Yeah. So let's take a transition now. Let's go to another piece of music. What should we play next?
Let's see. You could play Lean On by Major Lazer to kind of loosen the mood.
Okay.
Make it a little more fun.
Yeah. And do you want to say, to loosen the mood, anything else you want to say about this song?
This is a good dance piece. So if anyone's feeling like they want to jive around on this Sunday morning, definitely to this.
And okay, very good. Here we go.
Bold and young, all around the wind blows, we would only hold on to let go. Look
And that was Major Lazer and DJ Snake and Lean On. And our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Juliana Garcia. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. Juliana, what do you do? What do you do for fun? What do you do to just kind of, you know, enjoy life and, yeah, and take it easy? Because you're an intense woman.
Thank you. I don't know if that's a good thing, but
No. That isn't a compliment. You have a very high energy level. So what, yes, do you do for fun?
Definitely. A few things. So I play roller derby, mm-hmm, the League of Women's Rollers, which y'all actually come and broadcast our bouts. So that's awesome. Super grateful for that. I'm on the Blue Stockings. So right now we're in the off season, which is nice. We have a little bit of a break before we start back up in January. Mm-hmm. And all the new girls are kind of learning how to skate. So it's a very interesting process because a year ago I couldn't skate at all. And now I'm an awesome skater.
So how did you pick roller derby?
Yeah, it was kind of interesting. I really just saw a sign at Cass Park that said roller derby tonight. And I was like, awesome, I'm going to do that. So it was pretty out of the blue. It was when I knew I was going to stay in Ithaca after graduating. And I was like, wow, I need to find something to do and mm-hmm. find some friends.
Right.
An organized sport seemed like a really good way to do that. And I just really wanted to participate in a sport. But it's really hard to do that once you're older. Because if you didn't grow up playing that sport, everyone's like, oh, you're not that good. We don't really want you, you know?
Right. And at this point, nobody did roller derby growing up. I mean, it's all something that people come to later in life. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now
yeah.
we're starting to get into the younger girls who've been playing our junior league. Uh-huh, I'm really excited to see that generation grow up and play just to see how much the game will change. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. 'Cause right now it's most people start in their 20s. And there's a difference in kids who've been skating, like, you know, since they were 8 all the way through
right.
than a 20-year-old right. starting. So
what is it that you like about roller derby? What keeps you going?
Yeah. There are just so many things. So it's nice to be able to hit people. I know that sounds super weird, but you can get a lot of your aggression out as long as you're clean about it.
Yeah, yeah. It's a physical sport.
It is a physical sport, and that there aren't very many physical sports for women. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Unless you go to the super extreme of like boxing and stuff, which I don't really want to do that, right. you know, because this is a physical sport.
Or mixed martial arts or whatever. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. So it's really nice. And just skating is mm-hmm. a lot of fun. I don't know if, you know, you've roller skated in your past. I'm kind of sad that it isn't a thing anymore. Right. We're hoping it gets revived at some point.
It was roller skating, then it was rollerblading, and now it's back to roller skating. And yeah,
yes,
yeah,
definitely.
Yeah.
So just being able to go fast.
Right.
That too. And just the camaraderie with my team.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
These girls have become some of my best friends here. So it's really nice to be able to find a community with, you know, you have the shared experience of knowing what it's like to get beat up by huge girls. So,
right. So, yeah. Right. And I guess and having this is we're flipping the usual conversation here because there's kind of either an explicit or implicit either glorification of the roughness of men's sports or putting it down.
Mm-hmm.
And I want neither of those things to be here. But what is the experience? What do you and what do you perceive your peers get out of this freedom to be physically rough and violent?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say it's just the freedom itself to do that, because in a normal setting, you can't really do that. And there are a lot of rules. Obviously, social etiquette, you can't just go up and like run right. into someone. But it's just having, I don't know, I'm trying to figure out how to answer your question, but it's just having the training and being able to do it in an empowering way. So you're not just going and running up to someone and, you know, just running into them. It's like, okay, this is what I'm going to do. It's very strategic.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, and I'm doing this move so this other person can do this move. So it's like a
dance
in a way.
And somebody gets ahead, yeah.
Yeah, so you're kind of, you're doing it strategically. So it's not really just hitting people to hit people, you know? It's
you're
like,
not hitting people to hurt them.
Yeah, you're not trying to hurt them. I would, like, hate when I knock over a teammate and she gets hurt. It's like the saddest thing ever. I'm like, I'm so sorry, I didn't mean to, you know? But it's more of being able to get your team to the next level
mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
doing it in the most efficiently way possible and working together. That's the real thing, is just working together. And that's what I love about it. It's like, okay, I know I'm going to do this and then you do this.
Right.
So.
Right.
I don't know if that answers your question, but
no, that I mean, yeah, I mean, it allows you to use your whole self,
mm-hmm.
your body and your mind and your emotion and put it all in play.
Definitely. It's a lot about planning ahead.
And how do you practice for that? How do you develop that skill?
Mostly the steep learning curve of just learning how to skate.
Well, yeah, you got to be able to be on your feet.
Yes, that's definitely the hard part, is just learning how to stay up. So we practice like 3 times a week, and then we practice certain drills, and you just kind of run through them over, and just like any sport, you know.
What are the drills like? I'm just trying to figure out, how do you prepare for this physical contact sport?
So we'll do a scrimmage, but before scrimmages, we'll always do a few drills of, you know, you get 4 people in place, the blockers, and then you get 1 jammer in place. So how do you maneuver your way? So you'll practice different setups that you have. So it's like, okay, we're going to practice this setup, and this isn't for the jammers. We'll say this isn't for the jammers, this isn't for the blockers. So for example, if it's not for the jammers, then don't like bust through.
You're going to have to define jammers and blockers,
So with roller derby, you have 5 people from each team on the track at a time. And then 1 jammer from each team. So the jammers have the little stars on their heads, and they're the ones who can score the points. So their goal is to get past each blocker on the other team. So for each blocker you pass on the other team, you get 1 point. So if you're a blocker, you obviously don't want a jammer going past you. So you're going to try to, you know, maneuver your way around so that they don't get past you. So like I was saying, when you're doing drills, you're figuring out who's it for. So you're trying to build the skill of the blockers. So, you know,
Know how to read.
Yeah. So they know how to do it. So you practice it slow at first. You know, it's like, okay, if I come here and hit here as a jammer, what are you going to do to counter that move as a blocker? So it's like practicing a lot of things slower. So then you kind of just build the muscle memory. So then when it is the fast impact, you're like, okay, I know exactly what to do now. So that, it's a lot of that. It's not just chaos everywhere. Although if you come to practice, you'll probably think it looks like chaos.
Well, almost anything that moves quick and involves physical contacts look like chaos until you understand what's going on.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I mean, yeah.
And then we do scrimmages, and those are always fun because then you get to, you know, play all your cards.
And you, where do you do your practices?
It's over in Lansing, where the old skate park was. So like behind Rogues Harbor. So we get to practice there. It's pretty cold in the winter, but that's okay.
Right. And before that was a skate park, it was a grocery store.
Yes.
Many years ago. Yeah. Okay. So we're going to pull for another piece of music here. Okay. And then we're going to come to, okay. So what should we play next?
So I have Neon Moon on the agenda. That's a nice one.
Okie doke. And do you want to say anything about it in particular?
Yeah, it's funny because this is like a breakup song, but this is my boyfriend's and I like love song. So it's very odd.
So it's a paradox in your
life. Yeah, it's very weird, but you know, I love it. So. Okay.
The sun goes down on my side of town. That lonesome feeling comes to my door, and the whole world turns blue. There's a rundown bar across the railroad track. I got a table for two way in the back where I sit alone. Think of losing you. I spend most every night beneath the light of a neon moon. Now if you lose your one and only, there's always room here for the lonely. Go watch your broken dreams dancing in. I think of 2 young lovers running wild and free. I close my eyes and sometimes see you in the shadows of this smoke-filled room. No telling how many tears I've sat here and cried, or how many lies that I've lied, telling my poor heart she'll come back someday. Oh, but I'll be alright as long as there's light from a neon moon.
sad songs seem to say what I think, and it's hurt inside of me. Ain't never gonna end. Oh, but I'll be alright as long as there's light from a neon.
Was Brooks and Dunn and Neon Moon, and our guest on this hour is Juliana Garcia. So Juliana, when we come to the final segment of this show, I ask people to reflect on, you know, what it is they do to take care of themselves intellectually, emotionally, physically, on a daily basis, weekly basis, monthly basis, just to kind of keep themselves renewed and up for life. What do you do?
So I would say I have, this is going to sound totally weird, but I have home days, quote unquote.
Sure.
So Saturday is my home day,
uh-huh.
Where my boyfriend and I, we just literally stay at home, right. Which is kind of a weird thing to just camp out at your house for literally the entire day. But it's very relaxing because usually I'm very much out and about, like almost the entire day, the rest of the week.
Right.
So it's nice to just stay at home. Yesterday we played Scattergories. That was awesome.
Right.
So just having that ability to sleep in for one day, stay at home, make food together, all that stuff. And it makes you appreciate the other days, because this morning I was like, oh my God, I'm so excited to leave my apartment, because I literally did not leave my apartment at all. Mm-hmm. So it makes me excited for the rest of the week, because it's like, cool, I'm going to leave. Right. It's going to be great. So I would say that's really my main form. It's just compacting all of the self-care into one really extensive day. And just all the other things that I do. I really get a lot of energy from other people. So I enjoy hanging out with other people. Yes. So I'm very much an extrovert.
Yeah.
So that's a lot of my self-care, is hanging out with people that I really enjoy spending time with.
Right.
You know, that helps me.
Yeah. And it does not sound weird to take a whole day off. I mean that's really the traditional understanding of Sabbath or Shabbat, is to take a whole day down. And in my own life I need to practice that, although what I'm finding is that I need to have consistent time every day to check in with my partner, and then a big chunk of time on Saturday. It's hard to devote the whole day given the nature of our lives. But it's what you're describing is very powerful, and that you do it so intentionally is really quite striking.
It's really nice, honestly.
Yeah.
I would suggest, if you can, everyone do it.
and from people from lots, from evangelical, Christian, from secular points of view, from Jewish points of view, there are lots of good reasons to take that kind of time, down. Before we close, what kind of quality or what kind of feel would you hope to have in your life? What would you like to experience in life 10 to 20 years down the road? Where would you like to be?
Yes, I feel like with that, it's like subject to change daily.
Absolutely. But in yourself, where would you want to be inside yourself? Not all the accoutrements outside.
Inside. No, I know what you mean.
Yeah.
I think I would just want to be able to be surrounded by people who genuinely care about me and who I genuinely care about. Because a lot of times in this world, you just pass by people, really form those connections. So being able to be around people and looking around and say, yeah, that person really knows me, and they'd really you know, they'd really want to help me out if I needed something, and I really am always there to help them out. So in terms of like career stuff, it's like, I don't know where I'm going to be, know? But it's just being around like genuine people is really what I'm hoping my life goes and continues on to.
In a sense, it's like moving from law and criminal law to psych, neuropsych, and yet to more personal relationships. Mm-hmm. I mean, that shows that same kind of direction that you just described.
Yes, definitely.
Internally, and bringing it to fruition.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes. Yep.
You have one more song.
Yes.
And it's called
Carry the Zero.
Carry the Zero by Built to Spill.
Mm-hmm. They actually performed here a few years ago.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. What do you want to say about the song before we play it?
Oh man. My final closing thing. Yeah. I would just say it's a good song. I don't really have a whole spiel about
it, but
it's nice because it has some relaxing moments and it has some really, you know, more intense moments because it's a very long song. Sorry, guys.
right. And we're going to play about 3.5 minutes.
That's totally cool. So it kind of flows through the same way I flow through life, I would like to think.
Hey, that's cool. Thank you. Juliana, it's been wonderful to get to know you.
Thank you so much for having me.